Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to UC San Diego. Welcome to Eleanor Roosevelt College. Welcome to this, the seventh talk in the lecture series, The Making of the Modern World, To Be Human. My name is Alan Houston. I'm the provost, the chief administrative and academic officer for Eleanor Roosevelt College. I'm delighted to see all of you here and hope that you enjoy this evening's contribution. The Making of the Modern World is the signature course in Eleanor Roosevelt College general education sequence. It covers human history from the dawn of human time on Earth until the contemporary age. It's comparative, it's contextual, it's interdisciplinary. The primary venue in which MMW is communicated to our undergraduates is large lectures like this, the kind that Matthew Herbst delivered several weeks ago to you, the kind that Seth Lehrer will deliver to you tonight, and then small discussion sections, groups of 20 or 15 or 25 undergraduates who get together to talk about and think about and analyze and argue over the texts and themes and interpretations that are a part of the course. MMW is not confined to the traditional classroom, however. There are other venues in which it's communicated. For example, David Jordan, one of our instructors, a former provost of Warren College, a retired professor of anthropology, every year organizes a great museum caper, an opportunity for MMW undergraduates to go to the Museum of Man and the Museum of Art in Balboa Park and to look at the installations there in their relationship to the courses that they're taking. So we develop some connections between the museums within the town and the courses that students are taking. MMW students can take the courses themselves, not in a classroom like this, but in world historical settings that are related to the course material. MMW is taught in the summer in Berlin, in Athens, in Istanbul, in Paris. You can imagine spending 5 weeks in Istanbul with Matthew Herbst, the lecturer who many of you heard several weeks ago, as your tour guide, as your leader throughout many of the historic and religious and political sites in this extraordinary world city. And MMW involves taking students off of campus and into the world at large. One of our instructors, Edmund Chang, is involved in a volunteer effort at the Monarch School. It's a school for homeless children in the San Diego Unified School District. And Edmund takes MMW students down to the Monarch School to volunteer to perform acts of service, working with youth in that setting. So MMW, though it is primarily about lectures and reading and courses and discussion, it also has this texture of connection with the world. It helps to make it such a rich and vibrant and extraordinary set of classes. This lecture series is our way of trying to share with you, members of the community, some of the extraordinary riches, the wealth, the intellectual energy and vitality of the MMW sequence. It wouldn't have been possible without collaboration from the Chancellor's Associates, from UCSD alumni, from parent and family giving. Each of these organizations has helped us. The series itself would not have happened without the inspired guidance of my co-organizer, Steve Cassidy. Steve is a professor of Slavic and comparative literature. From 2001 to 2007, he was the director of the Making of the Modern World program. Tonight, he is our moderator. Please welcome Steve Cassidy.
It's a great pleasure to introduce to you this evening Seth Lehrer. He is Dean of the Division of Arts and Humanities and Distinguished Professor of Literature. I think I've mentioned that I've had some personal connections with a couple of the speakers here. This one tonight is crazy. Our mothers went to college together. Now, that was easy to figure out, because all I had to say was my mom was the girl at Brooklyn College whose last name was Levine, and that narrowed it right down. So these two young ladies apparently sat in an English lit course taught by a man with the great good fortune in the late 1940s to be named Adolf, I kid you not, Katzenellenbogen. That translates as cat's elbow. My mom wrote a satirical jingle making fun of his name. It got out. So I think it's safe to say that Seth's mom got a much better grade in that course than
like-minded.
Professor Lehrer comes to us from Stanford. He arrived in January of 2009, in time for the fiscal collapse. I know he enjoyed that. Educated at Wesleyan University, Oxford, again at Oxford, and received his PhD from the University of Chicago. His research and teaching interests, wide-ranging, medieval and Renaissance studies, comparative philology. There is a book for the layperson on the history of the English language, the history of scholarship itself, and a particular specialty, children's literature. Numerous awards and honors, many, many publications. I won't read them all for you. A number of his books are over on that table for sale. His recently published Wind in the Willows, an annotated edition, made a big splash when it came out a few years back in 2009. I also wanted to mention, as a feather in Professor Lehrer's cap, that he, on coming here in the midst of all of this turmoil and the state budget crisis, managed against all odds to resurrect, revivify the Center for Humanities. And the Center for Humanities has many things to boast right now, and I won't read them all for you, but it's back and up and running. And lastly, he's a very, very good pianist. So I'd like to ask you to join me in welcoming to the podium Dean Seth Lehrer, who will be speaking this evening on The Verve, How We Became Modern.
Thank you all very much, Steve and Alan. It's such a great pleasure to be here in this great hall. It's such a great pleasure, as always, to be welcomed by the UC San Diego community and to have the opportunity to share some thoughts about the history of Western culture, notions of language, and a sense of self that's been informing so much of my work and my teaching, really for the past 30 years. My title, I hope all of you can see, is The Verve, How We Became Modern. And any of you who have been following recent scholarship, popular writing, and history will know that my title is a play on words. In his recent and award-winning study of the early modern intellect, Professor Steven Greenblatt of Harvard has argued that the Renaissance recovery of works of classical philosophy sparked a new conception of the world and our place in it. Greenblatt calls his book The Swerve, How We Became Modern, How the World Became Modern. And in it, he traces how a 15th century Italian scholar encountered the work of an almost forgotten Roman poet. And he shows how, during the period from the 15th through the 17th centuries, something unique happened in Western culture, a flourishing of art and science, of intellect and idea. A culture he developed, he argues, that, quote, embraced beauty and pleasure as legitimate and a worthy human pursuit. In short, that culture was the Renaissance. It gave us Leonardo, Galileo, Michelangelo, Montaigne, Cervantes, Shakespeare, Bacon, Raleigh, Hooker, and countless others. Something happened in the Renaissance, Professor Greenblatt writes, something that surged up against the constraints that centuries had constructed against curiosity, desire, individuality, sustained attention to the material world, the claims of the body. What happened was not so much a rejection of the medieval world that came before it, but a development of inquiries and ideologies anew. In short, we could say that the Renaissance turned its eyes away from angels and demons to the things of this world. But of course, the world did not change overnight. Whole swaths of European farmers and townspeople, soldiers and religious men and women continued to live in worlds of angels and demons, as they do here in this remarkable painting by Peter Bruegel. Few people were as rational in the Renaissance as we would want them to be. And even then, amidst the courts of culture and creativity, there wafted the smoke of Inquisition. The same age that gave us Leonardo gave us Torquemada. The bureaucracies of Tudor splendor or Medici wealth were matched in intricacy and power by the institutions of the church. Indeed, if Stephen Greenblatt's book presents an argument for intellection as the path through which the world became modern, the equally recent book by Colin Murphy, God's Jury, makes a contrasting point in its own subtitle, The Inquisition and the Making of the Modern World. Surveillance, monitoring, surreptition, fear, all of them wedded to an elaborate machinery of textual reporting. These are, in Murphy's formulation, the scaffolds of modernity. He writes, and I quote, "The advent of the Inquisition offered a lens. Through it lies the world we inhabit now, one in which privacy and freedom of conscience are pitted against forces that would contain them. This is a central contest of the modern era and of the centuries that lie ahead." And Murphy's book argues that in a post-inquisitional world, the inroads of the internet give rise to questions about censorship, about the meaning of truth, about the nature of information and disinformation. Amidst this welter of debate, the clash of scholars and the contestations of desire, what really makes us modern? How do we understand the ways in which a period of time that we have labeled the Renaissance defined Western culture, not only as we live it, but as we are taught to appreciate it? What is the motto of modernity? Should it be cogito ergo sum, or should it be no one expects the Spanish Inquisition? Are we left merely with the cynicism of Harry Lime, the post-war racketeer portrayed with oily seductiveness in the great film The Third Man by Orson Welles, when he bids farewell to his naive friend at the Ferris wheel, played by Joseph Cotten, and he says, "You know what that fellow said. In Italy, for 30 years under the Borgias, they had warfare, terror, murder, and bloodshed, but they produced Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and the Renaissance. In Switzerland, they had brotherly love. They had 500 years of democracy and peace. And what did they produce? The cuckoo clock." What Orson Welles has at this moment, what Shakespeare had, what the Borgias had, what Da Vinci had, what Stephen Greenblatt has, what we all have, is verve. To read through all the stories of this golden age, to understand the beauty and the beastliness of early modern culture, is to see again and again individuals acting with a powerful sense of their own inability to act. They have what the 15th century Italian courtiers called sprezzatura. Baldassare Castiglioni, the author of The Book of the Courtier, and in my mind, the bearer of one of the most fantastic pieces of headgear in Western culture, defines sprezzatura as, quote, "a certain nonchalance so as to conceal all art and make whatever one does or says appear to be without effort and almost without any thought to it." Sprezzatura is a way of being in public, an artful artlessness, a skill at performance in word and deed. It is, in short, a verve for life, whether in the study or on the stage, whether in public or in private. It seems to me that at the heart of modern Western cultural identity is this unique sense of performance. It is, as we see here in this remarkable picture by Bronzino, the idea of you looking at me, looking at me, looking at you. The sense of the theatricality of introspection, the idea that even at our most private moments, we are on a stage set. And even in our most public spaces, we can pause, and see ourselves. Modernity is a courtier surrounded by a king's supplicants, passing before a mirror on the way to a meeting and pausing ever so briefly to look at himself in front of others. It is this complexity of self-absorption and theatricality that characterizes so much of what we traditionally think of as Renaissance culture, thought, and artistry. It's what links together Greenblatt and Murphy, the glorious and the grotesque. What I would like to do tonight is offer some reflections on the nature of how this sense of verve delineates the modern human being. Because I am a scholar of literature and of creative culture, I want to focus on the ways in which the verve is not just lived, but represented, how it is shown in art and poetry and drama. I also want to draw on my own sense of being a scholar to illustrate some ways in which this very sense of intellectual life has its origins in the Renaissance, but to show too that scholarship itself is a performance. In short, I'm going to move along the axes of the study and the stage. Let me begin with who I am. I don't know if any of you have seen Facebook recently, but there's a new trope on Facebook where there's a sign of a word, and then it says what my mother thinks I am, what my friends think I am, what I think I am, what I really am. This is what I think I am. I think I'm the scholar in the study. I'm a scholar of the past. I read and I write. I go to libraries and I search for old texts or testimonies. I am a teacher too, trying to convey my enthusiasm for the power of the past to present students occupied with iPads. Who are my forebears? In one sense, they are the great humanists of Italy and England and the Low Countries from the mid-15th through the late 16th century. These were people like Poggio Bracciolini, the bibliophile and scholar, the hero of Greenblatt's book. Men like John Collett, the dean of St. Paul's, in this beautiful line drawing by Hans Holbein. Men like Desiderius, Erasmus. These men and many of their contemporaries came to understand the nature of the past and the experience of the present through the study of language. Now, I want to pause and make an important point. Many of us think of the Renaissance as the discovery of the individual, as the focus on the human, as the articulation of the self. I want to suggest that the Renaissance is an act, if you like, of highly complicated lexicography. What these scholars noticed when they looked at old manuscripts, this is a 5th century manuscript of Virgil's Aeneid, and they noticed that the Latin of the classical authors was different in spelling, in grammar, in vocabulary, from the Latin of their own time, the Latin of the medieval church or the Renaissance scholar. And what they realized for the first time was that language changes over time. Historical distance came to be understood as a function of language change. Words that once had meaning no longer have meaning. Pronunciations and spellings changed in the past. The mutability of the world was understood as the mutability of the word. These scholars were not, of course, the first to notice this. The Italian poet Francis Petrarch noticed this in the 14th century, and even Dante, a generation before Petrarch, noticed how the emergence of vernacular languages out of Latin signaled a displacement of the past. But what I want to suggest is that this humanist world is not simply a privileging of the human, it's the recognition of the pastness of the past, the idea that history does not move along lines between fixed points of incarnation or creation, but that things change. And the way things change is in language. Time was to be measured by a sequence of cultural periods marked by language and human behavior. In the 14th century, in the 1380s, Geoffrey Chaucer, the English poet, also intuited this. And what makes Chaucer more a Renaissance than a medieval poet is a set of phrases like this. This is a passage from his poem, Troilus and Crusade, which I am going to read in the Middle English of Chaucer's time and translate for you. And he says, "Ye know, ek, that in form of speech is change within a thousand year, and word as though that hadden priest knew wonder niece, and strange us thinketh him, and yet they spak him so, and spared as well in love as men know do." You know, in fact, that speech in its form changes in the course of a thousand years, and words that once had value or meaning now seem remarkably funny and strange to us. And yet, people really talked like that, and they were as successful in love back then as we are now. Chaucer recognized that words once had price, that is, price, meaning, or value, and now they seem strange. But nonetheless, human behavior may remain a constant. From these 14th century stirrings, 15th and 16th century scholars set themselves the task of editing old texts, and they came to understand that the nature of modernity lay precisely in the ways in which words that once had pris now seem nice and strange. What the Renaissance invented was not just the modern world as we know it. The Renaissance invented the idea of modernity. And the idea is, I'm suggesting, one grounded in this notion of language change. In the course of this invention, Renaissance scholars recreated a new language, a supple Latin rich with classical allusion. In the process, they brought a new level of sophistication, not just to editing and scholarship, but to personal communication. They reinvented the personal letter. From the 15th to the 17th century, the personal letter became the primary means of expressing the self. Modernity can be measured in the letter. And the character of a person was the same as his character of handwriting, an inner quality of mind as much as the outward representation of that quality in handwriting. You will remember Erasmus. A century after Chaucer's death, Desiderius Erasmus wrote a handbook about how to write letters. In Latin, it's called De Conscribendis Epistolis, How to Write a Letter, on the Art of Writing Letters. It marks a key text in the history of public and private life. Towards the beginning of this treatise, this is what Erasmus is saying. He talks about how a letter can bring an absent friend back, how it can make someone physically present, and how the markings of the hand can convey the voice and presence of a writer. But here is the fascinating passage. "For this ought to be the character of the letter, as if you were whispering in a corner with a dear friend, not shouting in the theater, or otherwise somewhat unrestrainedly. For we commit many things to letters which it would be shameful to express openly in public." The character of the letter is not just its nature as a form of discourse, but the very characters in which it was written. This doubleness of meaning, this playful ambiguity between the inner and the outer, the private and the public, the whispered and the theatrically declaimed, this doubleness offers us the axes for the courtly culture of the Renaissance. Indeed, the very question of performance itself is at the heart of intellection for that time. Erasmus himself and his many peers and followers were not just writers in the study, but teachers at the podium. As the scholar Lisa Jardine has explored in her brilliant book, Erasmus, Man of Letters, subtitled The Construction of Charisma in Print, the scholar teacher of the Renaissance saw all forms of instruction as rhetorical. Language was gestural. The authority of the scholar and the teacher came not just from the arguments that he used, but from the public verve with which he deployed them. The scholar is an embodied figure, and his character was as much a part of his authority as his knowledge. Character, in all senses of the word, had to be located in the instrument that wrote, and this is in the hand. If you look at Renaissance portraits, and I'm just going to show you a few of them, the next time you're in a museum, The next time you're on the web, the next time you are looking around at representations of others, pay attention to the hands. Here is Erasmus. Notice that he is defined as a writer holding the book. Here, the courtier and mathematician of the 16th century, defined with the instruments of his work, the compass and the dodecahedron. And here, in one of the most remarkable paintings of the 16th century, the royal falconer Robert Chessman, holding the falcon in the same way that Erasmus and the merchant hold things in their hand. To know the character of an individual in these worlds is not to look at the face, but to look at the hand. What does the Renaissance man hold in his hand? Nowhere in English literature are these features constellated with such brilliance as in Shakespeare's Hamlet, represented here by Laurence Olivier. Hamlet is many things, but he's first and foremost a university student, schooled in the rhetoric of understanding and expression, a man of letters in all senses of that phrase, a son who comes home from school to find his father dead, his mother remarried, and the intrigues of the court played out like theater. Letters fill the play, as we can see here in this clip from a Derek Jacobi performance. Love missives written to Ophelia and intercepted by Polonius, the diplomatic correspondence that Hamlet intercepts from Rosencrantz and Guildenstern. Hamlet is a creature of the schoolroom, stuck inside the court. He enters in one scene carrying a book, and Polonius says to him, "What do you read, my lord?" And he simply answers, "Words, words, words." The figure of the scholar trapped in the confines of the court is an icon of modernity. Hamlet, as so many of us have noticed, is a play that traces the emergence of the modern individual, moving from the study to the stage, recognizing that modern life involves negotiations among cultural forms and identities. Hamlet, as much as any 16th century scholar of language, confronts the past through language. He recognizes that words that once had price are now foolish. The discourses of the court bore him. Only when the traveling actors enter in Act Two of the play does he come alive. And he recognizes that actors are the true royalty of modern culture. But he understands the deeply theatrical nature of all politics. When he announces, "The play's the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king," what he is saying is not just that he'll catch his uncle in the guilt of his crime, he's avowing that in all matters personal and political, we are players on a stage. Hamlet is a character trapped in his own characterization, a player challenged by the expectations of the audience, a student stymied by the scripts of obedience and recitation. If he is something of a failed performer, he is also a humanist manqué. Much like a figure out of Holbein's court two generations earlier, Hamlet remains a creature of the hand, and this brilliant representation of David Tennant, for many people of our students' age, the icon of the science fiction character of Doctor Who, now playing Hamlet in modern dress, holding the skull. This moment, Act Five, the scene with Yorick's skull, gives us the very sense of the verve. Here hung those lips that I have kissed, I know not how oft. Where be your jibes now, your gambols, your songs, your flashes of merriment that were wont to set the table on a roar? Speaking to Yorick's skull, Hamlet reflects on the very issues he had asked himself two acts before. To be or not to be, that is the question. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles, and by opposing, end them. The question, Latin, quaestio, it doesn't simply mean question, but in Renaissance Latin, the quaestio was the question called by Renaissance schoolboys in rhetorical debate. If any of you have done forensics, high school debate, contemporary argument, been a lawyer, you'll know that you need to argue both sides of the case equally. Resolved that a man should marry. Resolved that summer is better than winter. Resolved that wine is better than water. Resolved to be or not to be. Such resolutions honed the Renaissance student through the play of mind, the ability to take all sides of a question and argue them equally. Such activity may be familiar to you, as I have said, if you're a debater or if you are a lawyer, but such activity must be familiar to any of you who may be an actor. For by taking up an argument for the sake of argument, we take on a role. We impersonate a character. We live in the theater of the contrary or the counterfactual, resolved to be or not to be. Hamlet debates within himself, or perhaps even Hamlet interrogates himself, or perhaps this is Hamlet's inquisition. It is an internal inquisition, plumbing the soul for truth itself. In modern character lies the ability to hold two contrasting positions, to argue for them as well, and to show that public life is a rhetorical position. Hamlet knows this, yet he fails. So too does Shakespeare's Prospero from The Tempest. Prospero is a politician far too scholarly for his own good, an exile on an island with his daughter as his single pupil, a figure of the study and the stage who can lament, "Poor man, my library was dukedom large enough." And yet, that library was a stage large enough. Prospero, if any of you know the play The Tempest, is as much a playwright and a stage manager as he is a scholar. And the storm that he conjures at the beginning of the play, or the illusions that he offers midway through, or the mask of love that he oversees, are all the works of stagecraft. And at the end, he announces, "Our revels now are ended." Stagecraft, but it is scripted. From whence did Prospero learn his art? From books. At the play's end, abjuring artifice in favor of artlessness that would bring him back home to Milan, Prospero says, "I'll drown my book." And when he announces that the revels are ended, he calls down the stage theatrics for a recognition that to spend too much time with the curtain up is to lose sight of human sympathy. Hamlet and Prospero are modern characters in that they represent the tensions between the study and the stage, the public and the private, language and time. I don't know that I'd go so far as to say with some that Shakespeare invented modern character, but he certainly made such characters indelible in our cultural memory. Figures such as Hamlet and Prospero and the host of characters that Shakespeare created made it possible to reflect on the fundamental theatricality of the human and social. They also made it possible to offer any fictive experience through their lens. It is not just possible to be Shakespearean, it is impossible not to be Shakespearean. This is the problem of Milton's Satan. In Paradise Lost, Milton is creating in the figure of Satan a figure of such powerful rhetorical theatrics that he comes off as Shakespearean in form. Now, it is well known among scholars that Milton originally planned the work of Paradise Lost as a stage tragedy. And several of Satan's great speeches in the poem began as blank verse soliloquies in the Shakespearean tradition. But this is Satan's problem too, not just Milton's. How do you define yourself as an individual? What is the force of character? Like Hamlet, Satan is many things. But like Hamlet, Satan is a courtier uncomfortable with the strictures of political obedience. Hamlet finds something rotten in the state of Denmark. Satan simply can't bear to be a courtier in the monarchy of God. He rebels. He leads bands of followers to found a new land far from heaven, and his hell is pandemonium. Better to rule in hell than serve in heaven, he says. His line may stand as both a clarion call and an epitaph for all modern politicians. Milton's modernity in Paradise Lost is the world not just of courtliness and scholarship, but of colonialism and exploitation. Even though Milton himself was Secretary for Foreign Tongues to the English Republic, a title that I wish existed today, among the many things people said to me when I was a child, "What do you want to be when you grow up, Seth?" I said, "I want to be Secretary for Foreign Tongues." Even though he was a master of the verse letter, there are no letters read or written in Paradise Lost. Neither Satan's nor God's diplomacy is done through the epistle. Instead, it is done through present speech and personal activity, and Satan himself is as much a political figure as he is a moral creature. Let me talk a little bit about Satan. Satan comes off as a great explorer, setting up his new world when he and the fallen angels, now devils, reach hell and build pandemonium. They, in Milton's words, dig out ribs of gold, building great palaces. And yet, when Adam and Eve set up in Eden, they are settlers, farming and cultivating. I'd like to suggest that we can think of this moment in Paradise Lost, this contrast, not just as a moral, but a political one. One deeply attuned to 17th century political and social events, the 1660s and 70s, when Milton is writing and publishing and revising the poem. What is the new world? Is it a world of gold and despotism, of bullion economy and excess? Or is it a world of cultivated gardens, of quiet pastoralism, of settlement and security? As I scanned the web for illustrations for this talk, this 18th century picture struck me of Satan addressing his minions as conjuring exactly what I'd like. For in my view, Satan's hell, for Milton, is an Iberian Catholic South America of the 17th century. A land of gold and exploitation, of greed. By contrast, this is Eden, a Dutch Protestant North America. A land of settlement, of pastoral economy, a land of, dare I say it in this room, shared governance. Even in Eden, the words are significant. And when we first see Eden, we see it through Satan's eyes. And Satan calls it a landskip. And Milton spells it landskip. Now you could say, oh, this is an archaic way of spelling landskip. It's not. It's the Dutch way of spelling landscape. Milton spells the word as if it were Dutch, deliberately. He's borrowing it from the Dutch, and he wants you to see Eden as this, as a 17th century Dutch landscape painting, peaceable, enameled, colored, and artistic. So on he fares. This is Satan coming upon Eden now. And to the border comes of Eden, where delicious paradise, now nearer, crowns with her enclosure green, as with a rural mound the champaign head of steep wilderness, whose hairy sides with thicket overgrown, grotesque and wild, access denied. And overhead up grew, insuperable height of loftiest shade, cedar and pine and fir and branching palm. This is the world of Eden that Satan sees, a sylvan scene, and then he says, a woody theater of stateliest view. I've quoted this passage at length to show how we see Eden through the eyes of the individual that Milton calls the artificer of fraud. It is a woody theater, not just a place that is wooden, full of trees, but in fact, a place of artifice. For someone of Milton's age to read the phrase woody theater, how could they not recall that moment in Shakespeare when the prologue to Henry V refers to the play as taking place in this great wooden O. And this is the only surviving contemporary picture we have of the Swan Theater from the 1590s. The enameled colors, the word landscape, the whole image here, all of this shows us a truly modern world. And we come upon it, we can see it only through eyes accustomed to art. In As You Like It, Shakespeare's character Jacres says, "All the world's a stage." So too is Eden. Can one truly be oneself on the stage of life? Or does one only play a part? Erasmus claimed that letters should be like whispering in the corner rather than shouting on the stage. And yet, what would be whispered in such corners? Intrigue and surreptition were the mark of politics long before we ever thought of ourselves as modern. Adam and Eve speak openly to each other, but Satan whispers in Eve's ear, and when he finally convinces her to eat the apple, he becomes an actor, an orator, a public figure, a speaker out of one of Shakespeare's or the public forums. And I can think of no better picture to illustrate the Satan I imagine at this moment than this. Now more bold the tempter, but with show of zeal and love to man and indignation at his wrong, new part puts on. And as to passion moved, fluctuates disturbed, yet comely, and in act raised as of some great matter to begin, as when of old some orator renowned in Athens or in Rome, where eloquence flourished, since mute, to some great cause addressed, stood in himself collected, while each part, motion, each act, one audience, ere the tongue, sometimes in height began, as no delay of preface, brooking through his zeal of right, so standing, moving, or to height upgrown, the tempter, all impassioned, thus began. At this moment of satanic speechifying, of sublime manipulation, the heart of modern Western world emerges. The politician as actor. The man convincing the woman to do something that she knows is wrong. The purveyor of knowledge that we should not know. Just eat it. Mario Cuomo, the former governor of New York State, and perhaps the most Shakespearean of modern politicians, once said, "Politicians campaign in poetry, but govern in prose." Would that Satan had known this. But Milton did. His God, his ruler and majesty, if you read the poem, God speaks in some of the most prosaic lines of anyone whose words may fit a meter. There are no epic similes in God's heaven. There are no metaphors of magnificence. Yet Satan, the great rhetorician, shows us that he lives constantly in the campaign. As if to twist on Shakespeare's Henry V, who could move men to martial prowess only through a word, who could, in the great St. Crispin's Day speech, commend them as the happy few, Milton gives us in Satan a true despot of modernity, all in a moment. Through the gloom were seen 10,000 banners rise into the air. And when Satan finishes his great speech at the beginning of the poem, he says, "Peace is despaired, for who can think submission?" And then Milton says, "He spoke. And to confirm his words, out flew millions of flaming swords drawn from the thighs of mighty cherubim." This is as much high theater as the flames of Inquisition that precisely at this time would rage across southern Europe. The flames of Satan's minions flicker against the auto da fe that would light up Mediterranean skies. They gleam against the nearly countless deaths by fires that martyrs of all convictions would endure. They shine against the book burnings that censors from antiquity to the present have believed would erase dissent. Scholarship and exploration, flame and fear, knowledge and need, theater and thoughtfulness, All of these are elements of the truly modern, mixed in them like in no other. Hamlet, Prospero, Satan, as I've suggested here, the crisis of early modernity lies in the representational challenge of performance. Is there an artlessness to courtier display? Does Hamlet fail? Does Satan go too far? Does Prospero give up? Some of you sitting here may ask, all he's done is talk of books. What of science? Didn't modernity begin as men looked up not to find angels in the heavens, but planets in the dark? Did not the light of knowledge take us out of alchemical warrens and put us into well-lit labs of chemistry? It did. But it did so, I would conclude, through the theatrics of the arts of chemical display, the staging of the stars, the theater of the laboratory. How can we not see all the magicians from Prospero on backwards? How can we not see art and literature behind this painting? This is a painting of Hennig Brand, supposedly the last alchemist, perhaps the first chemist. Hennig Brand found phosphorus. He's considered to be the discoverer of phosphorus. He found it out of the putrefaction of his own urine in 1669. And this great painting by the later 18th century painter Joseph Wright gives us an indelible image of the scientist as a figure out of the imagination. He kneels before the glowing retort, where the phosphorus is, more like a man of God than a man of science. His robe and his rope belt are the icons of the hermit-like saint. And in the phosphorescence of this night, his faith is bathed less with the knowledge of the elements than with the blessedness of inspiration. This is a painting not about the things of this world, but about angels and demons. I first saw this painting when I was 7, when we went to the Brooklyn Public Library and we found the Time-Life Book of Matter. And this painting was splayed across its pages, and it inspired me as a boy to try to be a scientist. As a child, I built a laboratory out of retorts and reagents. I imagined myself discovering an element, there were only 102 of them then, or conjuring a polymer out of the dross of household chemicals I'd find under the kitchen sink. As I grew up, I left the elements and the stars for words. Instead of labs, I've lived in libraries. And now, I am an academic dean. I spend my hours not with manuscripts, but with spreadsheets. I turn my skills at rhetoric not to the eager student, but to, I hope, the equally eager donor. Where be my jibes now? Have I lost my verve? Each day, I question who I was and what I have become. And in the end, that is the most modern of questions, a reflection on the private self as a professional in public life, a reflection equally at home in the court of Denmark or on Prospero's Island or in Satan's hell. What made us modern, I will leave you with in conclusion, is less an attention to the things of this world, scientific, empirical, objective, than the refraction of those things through the imagination. What the history of Renaissance society or inquisitorial bureaucracy or art or literature tells us is that to be a modern person is to live as an individual in a world of institutions. All the world's a stage. A library is dukedom large enough. And yet, in this picture, I think that we can see that even at the moment of discovery, there is awe. That even with the empirical, there is empathy. And that even with the seeming moment at the end of alchemy lies the recovery of gold from the dross of a man's urine. As I look at this picture, I cannot but reflect on 30 years of teaching, where after every class, I would receive a student evaluation, and the students would say in classes with titles like Chaucer, or The History of the English Language, or Poetry and Poetics, Professor Lehrer made dull material interesting. I am an alchemist of the imagination, transforming the dross of my material into the gold of experience. And it seems to me that at a place like the University of California at San Diego, we are all scientists or humanists, artists or physicians, alchemists of the imagination. And I want to leave you with this picture of the last alchemist, the first chemist, to think then of how the imagination as I have presented us not only makes us modern, but keeps us full of verve. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.